Welcome to Zoom. Enter your meeting ID followed by hash. The meeting has not started. Please wait or try again later. Enter your participant ID followed by hash. Otherwise, just press hash to continue. Please enter the meeting passcode followed by hash. You have joined the meeting as an attendee and will be muted throughout the meeting.
Oh, hi everyone. Good afternoon, good morning, depending on where you're dialing in. I hope everyone can hear me loud and clear. We do have a few clients joining, I guess, from Malaysia, from London, and from Sydney today. Thank you very much. I will just go ahead to cover the key issues I have highlighted on my screen here. Okay, I put up the screen. I hope you can see it clearly. And there are many issues. Obviously, I think you have quite a few concerns about what has happened to the policy, you know, given many regulatory changes recently. And I guess we should also look at what's going on between U.S. and China, because we do have a key event coming up quite soon. So we'll talk about that. And so let me get it started. Let's take a quick look at, okay, page three here, right? We do have very strong GDP numbers from China in the first and the second quarter. First quarter, we had over 18%, and then close to 8% in the second quarter. But then I have to stress that we actually had a low base last year, so the numbers were more or less inflated by the base effect. If we look at the growth over the last 2 years and take an average, and the growth number for first quarter was just about 5%, second quarter 5.5%. So I think 5% is a more reasonable measure of the growth currently, and we can also expect a number close to 5% for the rest of this year. And next year, we also expect a growth at 5.5%. And I think importantly, we have seen the cyclical peak in China. It must be between Q4 and Q1 this year. Okay. The other thing I want to highlight is if we look at consumption growth in China, retail sales, for example, they are still quite disappointing. You can see on my chart here, retail sales were quite strong, stronger than GDP or IP growth for many years until about 2 to 3 years ago. And even after the pandemic, I think they are not they're still quite disappointing in the sense that they have yet to recover fully. And that really because I think the economy has struggled to create jobs before and after the pandemic. We don't have a very good measure on jobs. We only have this PMI component on employment. And it has been consistently below 50. And that really means that jobs are still contracting on a month-on-month basis. And that explains why we don't see any major CPI inflation, not at this point. And in fact, I think there may be a slight CPI deflation problem because prices were actually declining for a few months on a month-on-month basis. And that also explains why the PBOC has chosen to cut triple R a few weeks ago. No, they should actually tighten, but they have chosen to ease. And that is quite interesting, as I show you on this next slide, because I do think that the economy is actually dealing with a major inflation, cost-driven inflation problem. You can see this chart on your left-hand side, especially when we look at the PPI index. You know, it is as bad as what we saw back in 2015 all the way to 16 or 17. Okay, similar shock. And the nature of this shock is also very similar because we have a very aggressive central bank behind First of all, it's the Fed, and then it's the PBOC. Both are being very aggressive in creating liquidity, and liquidity has ended up in the wrong areas. And here in China, is being reflected in upstream producer prices, and most of these prices are imported. Okay. And bear in mind that back in 15 and 16, what happened after, you know, that inflation shock eventually led to a major cyclical slowdown in 18 and 19. Okay. So I think right now we are seeing a slowdown. You know, many indicators are turning down once again, and that have to do with this inflation. Okay, many factories, many industries are screaming because they operate on a very thin margin, and margins are being squeezed quite badly at the moment. The other thing we should pay attention is look at the trade prices. Okay, again, on the next page, you can see I highlighted the shock in 15 and 16. So we actually saw both export and prices going up very rapidly in that cycle. Eventually, what happened was China took on a lot of inflation, and China began to export that inflation to the rest of the world. Okay, we saw export prices going up quite rapidly. Now, we only have data up to April, but I think obviously the import pricing there has been going up quite rapidly. So I reckon we're going to see export prices going up quite rapidly in the next few months also. Okay, so that will work. That will actually help contribute to higher inflation in the U.S. Here, again, going into 16-17, U.S. CPI was going up approaching 3% in the end. That led to the Fed's tightening, enter a new tightening cycle. So I think eventually China will do exactly the same. And currently, U.S. CPI is already close to 5.4%. Okay, and tonight, we're going to have another print for July. Looks like we're going to have another new record high for U.S. CPI. So China will basically reinforce a bigger inflation problem for the U.S. I don't know what's going on with the Fed. I think the Fed is behind the curve. The Fed continues to say, okay, this inflation is transitory. I don't know how long they can keep saying that. I think at some point they have to acknowledge this is a bigger problem, the inflation shock, and they have to tell the market that, okay, we may have to tighten sooner, you know, sooner than probably the second half next year. And the tapering may also have to start early than early next year, for example. So they will have to telegraph this message to the market. And from the Chinese perspective, I cannot see why China will not export this inflation to the rest of the world. Okay. Well, I do have quite a few. Okay, quick. We have six participants so far. So thank you. Welcome. I hope you hear me loud and clear, so, because I cannot hear you. All right. Now, again, CPI is not a problem yet. That is because demand is still very sluggish, and that also explains why PBOC has chosen to ease. They should tighten, but they have chosen to ease. So I wouldn't be surprised that they may cut triple R once again. They may not cut interest rate. They will just leave interest rate where it is, but they may cut triple R. That may actually induce more inflation, more cost inflation on the PPI. Okay, so they're not working on the direction to address cost inflation. And I think the industries will continue to suffer, okay? But the PBOC is also concerned about the debt pressure. We have seen more debt defaults domestically, okay? Everybody is concerned about what may happen to Evergrande. You know, Evergrande has borrowed a lot of internal and external debt. So companies are screaming once again because of the debt burden, and it is approaching 350%. And I have also mentioned that if you just look at, if you assume that interest rate is just about 5% across the board, 5% is more or less the average corporate lending rate right now. So just to surface the interest of this debt, it needs 17% of GDP each year, okay? And obviously, the economy is not growing at 17%. And that, again, that explains why domestic demand continues to struggle and why the economy doesn't create jobs. Okay, so let's move on. I think we can talk a little bit about politics because we have seen many political moves. I would call them political moves rather than regulatory moves because we have to acknowledge that the things have been quite different politically ever since Xi Jinping took over. And especially when we enter the second term, you know, his second term began in 2017. So I think he has spent the last few years, first of all, re-centralizing a lot of power. You know, at some point, there were indeed many market-based reforms so that the power was decentralized to private companies, for example. But then I think we are seeing a backpedaling on those reforms. I think the economic model right now is something much, much closer to state capitalism because President Xi believes that the state should have the maximum control of key economic resources. And it was 2 years ago, for example, many private companies had to incorporate party committees, for example, including Alibaba and Tencent. So that the campaign actually began more than 2 years ago. And then suddenly, I think also began 2 years ago, that the role of big data, artificial intelligence, anything, you know, fintech, everything, you know, these things have got so important. They have become, I know that the state wants to manage it, own it, want to have maximum controls on these tools. And collectively, people call that digital Leninism. Okay, so that has to do with ideology also. So that explains many things. And I have always said that their bottom lines, these bottom lines cannot be compromised. The party must stay in power. I think more recently we have heard many references about national security. You know, national security has taken the front seat. So that, for example, fintech is very innovative, but then fintech can destabilize the state bank interests or state banking system. So that has to be addressed. And then recently, for example, they started cracking down on education. You know, suddenly they think that, okay, the birth rate has been on a decline, even after they abolished the one-child policy 5 years ago, but they're not happy about the results, and they think that, okay, the after-school tutoring has got so intense, so that has compromised the birth rate and hence productivity, and they must be cracked down. So again, the policy is very becoming more populist, more nationalistic, and in many ways more socialist. Okay, so that won't really change. Okay, unless you would argue that, okay, something politically happens. Possible. You know, we do have a party congress coming up in October next year. So that could potentially be a major game changer, but I cannot speculate any outcome. Of course, everybody assumes that Xi will secure his third term quite easily, even his fourth term quite easily. So unless there are some key changes at the top, I don't think we will see a turnaround on those policy directions. So this is one way to look at that. The other way is, because there is a trade war, there is a new antagonism between U.S. and China, that has given rise to this policy or strategy we call dual inward circulation. Again, it's all related, and that really began about a year ago. And again, it is mostly about promoting self-sufficiency. Okay. For the policy right now is that if they can avoid foreign imports, for example, they should do whatever it takes to avoid that. And recently, they talked about, for example, removing English curriculum, removing English courses from the normal primary school and secondary school curriculum in Shanghai, for example. And in terms of trade, I think they have also tried to restrict imports on several items, such as wines, foreign brand goods, garments, for example. They will continue to import things that are strategic, that are critical, like iron ore and computer chips. And so far, so good. I think the policy so far has been able to actually preserve or generate even more trade surplus. So I put a circle here. You can see over the last few quarters, China actually had better trade surplus overall. Again, they have to maintain a good level of foreign exchange just in case they realize that this is a long, long battle against the U.S. They call it a long game, that may take many, many, many years. So they are quite obsessed with having the foreign exchange right now. When it comes to the trade deal with the U.S., I think we have passed more than two-thirds of this trade deal, because in another 6 months, this trade deal will expire. And so far, they have done a reasonably good job. I think reasonably good, not great. They have at least been able to deliver something like 65 to 70% of what was promised to the U.S. in terms of making more purchases from the U.S., but that has come at an expense at other countries, such as Australia, Canada and Brazil. To a certain extent, may include Malaysia here. We do have clients dialing from KL, so I hope you can tell me a little bit more. So, because most importantly, we are not talking about China being able to create new demand. No, there's no way China can create new demand in order to fulfill that 200 billion purchase commitment. Okay, so what they're doing is very simple. They will cut back purchases from these countries like Australia in order to fulfill the trade deal with the U.S. That's why we are seeing more trade disputes with Australia in the last 12 months. You know, very obvious. Okay, and again, that won't change. And I doubt that that will appease the U.S. Again, China is only able to deliver 65-70%. And then U.S. has started to realize that China has practiced import substitution. Import substitution is not allowed under the WTO or the Phase 1 trade framework. No, it's not a good idea to do that. So while they will resume trade talks, I doubt they can come to any new deal, new agreement. Trade truce? No, I don't think so. They will talk, but I don't think that will take us to anywhere. Okay. Now, Biden has been in office for more than 6 months, and we now have a better idea about what his policy on China is like. First of all, obviously, you know, Biden has stopped calling China a threat. No, instead, he only calls China a strategic rival. So it looks like that is a, you know, that is an improvement already. But that is it. That is it. When it comes to many things here, I would say it's a Trump policy without Trump. Very simple. Decoupling. Yes, Biden is not so interested. You know, he keeps talking about trying to engage China on climate change, for example, and he has never talked about trying to bring jobs back from China to America. You know, he has only come up with $1 trillion spending program to bolster U.S. industrial competitiveness in infrastructure, R&D, for example. Okay, and it's coming. No, the big fiscal spending is coming. So that is the, I would say that is the key difference or nuance, if you call it. Otherwise, I would say in terms of financial measures, sanctions, Biden may have even doubled down on those measures. Bear in mind that Trump was quite reluctant to use financial sanctions until at the end of his term, and he put only 35 Chinese companies under sanctions. Biden has almost doubled that to 59, and looks like more will be added to the sanction list. Okay, and one major difference is Biden. You know, for many months, he said, oh, okay, we will not hold China accountable for the COVID-19. No. But suddenly, a few months ago, he said, oh, let's take a good look at what has happened. And he ordered the intelligence unit to investigate, to come up with a report. And the report is due to be released in the next 2 or 3 weeks. And I would say there is a very high chance that that report will point the finger to China, and that will change many things. That will open up a new round of escalations, and certainly I think there will be follow-up actions, possibly coordinated with G7, because last month G7 already came up with a very strong statement to say, okay, China, you have to come clean with what has happened to the COVID-19. So I do think that there's a good possibility of escalation, and then China will retaliate. China is already fully prepared for retaliation. So I'm worried that eventually China will begin to look at pick up some U.S. big companies and begin to think about sanctions against major big U.S. companies. All right. So on this page, page 14, I have highlighted the key fresh points in the near future. Obviously, we should pay attention to this COVID-19 report. We should also pay attention to future sanctions. There is a investment ban already on 59 companies, and there will be more. I'm worried that eventually U.S. may begin to use SDNs. SDN is a very severe form of sanctions, more severe than entity lists. 2 years ago, they were quite close to using SDN against Huawei, for example. So I wouldn't be surprised that eventually there may be some Chinese companies to be put under SDN. Right now, there are already, I think close to 100 Chinese companies under SDNs, but they are not listed companies. There's a small state player, so market doesn't care. But I'm worried that eventually there may be some listed ones to be under SDN. I'm also worried that there will be more sanctions on Hong Kong, either primary or secondary sanctions, especially against financial institutions. And finally, I think there is always a risk of geopolitical flashpoints, either in South China Sea or Taiwan. I think more likely in South China Sea than Taiwan. I heard that there are already 5 aircraft carriers, including U.S., and then the U.K. has joined, German has joined, and the French will join, so that in the next few months there will be 7 aircraft carriers, including non-U.S. aircraft carriers, patrolling the South China Sea. So you can see that it would be so easy to trigger one major military fresh point right in the South China Sea. Okay, so let's take a look at the investment ban I mentioned. There were 59 companies, so most of them have appeared here. I think I showed this table a few months ago. Looks like it has got longer and longer. There were 6 or 7 areas. Now there are 8, because again, Biden began to sanction Chinese companies on human rights ground. Okay, he may actually put a question mark on Hong Kong. So eventually, there may be companies being sanctioned because of Hong Kong. So this list will get longer over time. Now, you probably have huge concerns about what has happened to many tech companies, education companies. Okay, I have talked about how we see this issue from a political, ideological perspective. So let's take a look from another angle, okay? Many investors are aware that, okay, because of this financial war between U.S. and China, U.S. has already passed a new legislation to require over 200 Chinese companies listed in the U.S. to go through another regulatory procedure, okay, if they don't fulfill a new list of listing rules, including disclosure requirement, for example, they may be told to be delisted in the next 3 years. Okay. Now we don't know how many will face this delisting outcome. But let's say half of them will have to be delisted, you know, more than 100 companies. And altogether, the market cap based on the valuation in May, you know, they must be, valuation must be close to 1 trillion. So they have three options. Number one, you know, everybody talks about that. You know, they can go to Hong Kong. They can get a secondary listing in Hong Kong and everything will be just fine. So that U.S. shareholder will get a piece of share with Hong Kong Stock Exchange instead. So everything will be just smooth, no problem. One option, okay. But then I would argue that there are some problems with taking the listing to Hong Kong. First of all, let's say if 100 companies, you know, if U.S. investors are told not to invest in those 100 companies in the U.S., you know, they should also be told not to invest in the same companies listed in Hong Kong. I cannot see why there will be no further restriction. That doesn't make sense, right? You know, so there could be new restrictions on U.S. investors investing in those companies listed in Hong Kong, right? And then I mentioned there is an existing investment ban on 59 Chinese companies. Okay, they are listed in Hong Kong and in U.S. So U.S. investors cannot touch. I would imagine that the list will get longer, cover many more companies, right? And then I also mentioned there's a possibility of coordinated sanctions on Hong Kong, coordinated with European Union or G7, very possible. I think all the signs are telling me that Europe eventually will join hands. G7 is fully prepared. At least some of the G7 countries will join hands so that there will be some kind of investment ban, a list of investment ban that will require European American investors not to invest on a list, long list of companies. I don't know who they are, but they will, I think the list will just get longer so that it won't be so easy for this company to come to Hong Kong to do a secondary listing and say, oh, everything will be just fine. No, it won't be that easy. Okay, so that really leaves these companies to the next two options. They can do a listing back home in Shanghai or just do privatization, right? So, and effectively, they will be the same because both will involve raising cash, renminbi cash at home and pay back the U.S. shareholders in U.S. dollars. So this is a key difference. Okay. In Hong Kong, they can still raise dollars. HKD and USD, they are the same because of the pay. So that there won't be any foreign exchange issue. But with a secondary listing in Shanghai in Asia, there is a huge foreign exchange issue. First of all, look at one Chinese company, the TAL, okay? We all know what has happened to TAL. TAL went to America to raise $1.5 billion in IPO 10 years ago. Based on the valuation in May, that has been inflated to $56 billion. So 10 years ago, TAL sold $1.5 billion to the PBOC, and they got 9.8 billion yuan. And that allowed them to expand. You know, they have the business in China, so they got close to 10 billion yuan to expand. But now market cap reached 56 billion. So if we say to keep U.S. shareholders happy, they will have to raise 36 billion yuan at home, either relisting or privatization, you know, they raise cash by whatever means, and ask the PBOC for $56 billion. Okay, so this is the challenge. This is the challenge. And there are potentially many, many companies who do exactly the same. Potentially hundreds of these companies doing the same. So let's say if we go back to this example, talking about $1 trillion US dollars, eventually, will PBOC allow $1 trillion reduction in his reserve? You know, PBOC has to offer $1 trillion whole of his reserve and then allow to see 6.5 trillion money contraction at home, 6.5 yuan. That's a lot of money. They just decided to cut RRR by 50 basis points in order to release 1 trillion yuan to the market. So this is a very key concern, okay? That is almost a nightmare for the policymakers. And I can tell you, they are fully aware of that, fully aware. They are fully aware of a coming financial decoupling with the U.S. Okay. So I hope that can answer a lot of questions. Now, I want to also highlight that in Hong Kong, you are probably not aware that because there are already existing U.S. sanctions against individuals in Hong Kong and mostly individuals. Chinese government, Hong Kong government are thinking about introducing anti-sanctions law in Hong Kong. And if that happens, that could happen quite soon, you know, in a matter of weeks or months. If that happens, you know, I don't know what may happen, be honestly, because, for example, right now, banks like HSBC will have to enforce U.S. sanctions against our chief executive, Carrie Lam, for example. You know, Carrie Lam will have to cut loose everything with HSBC. With this new law coming, then if HSBC goes on enforcing sanctions against Carrie Lam, then HSBC will violate this new law. So HSBC can only choose between either to enforce U.S. sanctions or comply with this new law in Hong Kong. Okay. And if they do that, if HSBC say, okay, we won't enforce U.S. sanctions in Hong Kong, then they will step on to the secondary sanctions. The secondary sanctions will be very, very severe. Later on, I will show you. I hope that they won't, you know, but they will have to choose which side to take eventually, either siding with the U.S. or siding with China or Hong Kong. All right. I do have a bit of time constraint. So let's take a quick look at page 20. I have also shown this chart many times. It is important to look at the balance of payments. It is very important because of this trade war, this new antagonism, very, very important for China to preserve the foreign exchange. So far, they have done quite well in keeping the balance of payments in a little bit of surplus. There was a crisis in 15 and 16. They have managed to keep it in balance, more or less. FX reserve has been about 3 trillion ever since. But then how have they managed to do it? They have managed to do it by borrowing more dollars from overseas, especially from Hong Kong. So in terms of bank loans from Hong Kong to China, you know, that is of close to $900 billion, bonds close to $1 trillion, including a big chunk, that Evergrande has taken up, big chunk here. So that is already close to $1.9 trillion. I mentioned equity, U.S. is about $2 trillion, Hong Kong is about $5 trillion. $5 trillion in terms of market cap. So you can imagine it is so important, extremely important for China to keep coming to these markets to raise dollars in both debt and equity. Okay? But then I mentioned there is a financial decoupling coming up. So how can China manage to keep things in balance? How can China do that? If Evergrande falls, what may happen? You know, if bond investors start to feed, they get scared, you know, if Evergrande, you know, declares a major default, what may happen? So these are the questions. These are the questions we have to consider very, very carefully. Okay, I will skip a few slides. I mentioned there could be secondary sanctions. So it's on page 32. So yes, so these are the existing U.S. sanctions on Hong Kong. I think everybody is worried about potential secondary sanctions if banks do not enforce primary sanctions. So if we do see an anti-sanctions law coming to Hong Kong, then, you know, what would HSBC do eventually? I don't know. All right. Hong Kong so far is okay. I think if we look at the money flows condition on this chart, page 29, thanks to the Fed. The Fed came in, stepped in and printed a lot of money, and a lot of this money has ended up in Hong Kong. So we actually had extra $100 billion inflows over the pandemic. But then over the last few months, this money began to leave a little bit, not a lot, not enough to create a crisis. And you can see that the Hong Kong dollar was strong up until April, May. Yeah. So, and right now it's already 7.78. So that again indicates some money outflows already happening for whatever issues. That also happened before they announced new crackdown measures on Alibaba or education sector. Okay, so I will probably stop here, I guess I will just jump into your key concerns, your questions. Let me open up the floor. I'm going to do it again. I think you can put up your hand, you know, voice out your questions if you have. Do I have to unmute? Oh, no.
The host would like you to unmute your microphone.
So
you can press star 6 to
unmute everyone, so that you can talk. Yes, please feel free to raise any issues, or you want me to elaborate on anything.
Hello, hi, Kevin.
Hi.
Hi, Dawn here. Yeah, I'm just keen in terms of your thoughts on the VIE structure, right? Do you see the homecoming of the listed ADRs, you know, in the next few years?
Now, we have to understand that, you know, why was there a VIE structure in the first place? The VIE structure was convenient in the sense that, you know, it allowed these companies to bypass many listing restrictions, you know. And that was based on one single principle, was that China and U.S. were friends for many years. So that, you know, U.S. basically said, okay, Chinese companies can come to New York to list and raise money, raise our money, and we turn a blind eye on this loophole, you may call it loophole. Now, that was based on, you know, the principle that they were friends, but they are not friends anymore. Okay, so that's why I think the VIE structure has to be, you know, totally, I don't know. Something has to be done, and I think U.S. is doing something to address that loophole. So they are saying, okay, all these companies, 248 companies, has to go for a screening once again. If they do not pass certain hurdle, go home. Okay, but doesn't matter if you have VIE or not. Go home. And so that eventually, I think, you have to ask that question. Are U.S. and China are friends anymore? Okay. And then they could do it in Hong Kong with similar VIE structure in Hong Kong. Again, I mentioned that something may happen, in terms of other regulations or restrictions, so that the U.S. will tell its own investors, be careful if you invest in VIE companies in Hong Kong also, right? That's why I think things have changed. And I believe that Beijing is fully aware that, okay, in the future, it will be so more difficult for these companies, including SOEs, unicorn companies, to go out to US and even be Hong Kong to raise capital. So that they are saying, okay, come home, come back to Asia, come home. And that is exactly what dual inward circulation is about. Dual circulation is about, okay, and I'll forget about overseas market, forget about trade, we are going to decouple, and then companies will have to rely on renminbi liquidity, money, for future growth. So that's the idea.
Great. So do you see that more as a gradual tightening on both ends rather than a sudden sort of delisting that happened?
Okay. Now, last week, U.S. already said that no more new IPO from Chinese companies. So they already put a big sharp break on new Chinese IPO. So they realized that they have problems. After the recent market rout, okay, they have problems, so they stopped. And I think the delisting may come sooner than everybody expects. So it won't take 3 years. It will take... the time window will be shorter. And then Chinese companies will take advantage of very depressed share prices right now. So if say a company is already share price already close to IPO, then you will start hearing privatization, things like that. Okay. So then, you know, somebody will step in, somebody with a strong state background step in to privatize, right?
Sure, yeah. Oh, no, it makes sense, yeah, sure, yeah. I thought thinking as well, Hong Kong Exchange would be a, you know, a good beneficiary from this movement?
I have some doubts. Yeah, this is what the market consensus believes. They all say, okay, don't worry about it. These 100 companies will go to HKS, Hong Kong Stock Exchange. No, it's not that straightforward. The U.S. will make sure that that door will be closed also. And they have already given a lot of warning. You know, a few weeks ago, Biden already make a very clear, very rare warning to all U.S. businesses in Hong Kong. It's time for you to think about an exit plan. It's not safe, you know, he already made it work, it's not safe anymore. You know, you have to think about your own risk, investing in Hong Kong, keeping money in Hong Kong, for example. He already made it very clear.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thanks, Kevin.
All right. Great. Do we have any more questions from this little small group? Okay, otherwise I will just leave it here. You know, if you do have further questions, pushback, please do email me or call me anytime. I'll be very happy to address your concerns. So thank you very much for your time today. I hope everybody is doing great, keeping safe. Your family is also keeping safe. And hopefully I will meet you all in person quite soon. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Kevin.